Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Center for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXXXIV, Diarchy Plus One. Diocletian and Maximian must be doing something right, keeping the borders of Rome safe and ruling the empire in harmony. They even have time for a catch-up in Milan, worthy of a panegyric. Things would be perfect if it wasn't for the revolt of Carausius in Gaul and Britain, who doesn't want to rule Rome, he just wants to be included in the party. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
So the period between 286 and 293, when Diocletian and Maximian are co-Augusti, is called the Diarchy by modern scholars. And this is a term which simply means the rule of two, derives from ancient Greek. And the reason we use this term is because from 293, spoiler alert, there's going to be four emperors, which modern scholars call the Tetrarchy. So we look at this period in these different stages.
Why does the term diarchy come up in this instance, though? We've had examples earlier of there being two co-emperors, two rulers, Marcus Aurelius and person who I can't remember.
Lucius Verus.
Thank you.
That's okay.
Justice for Lucius Verus. Yes. So why is that not called a diarchy?
Because of the Tetrarchy, essentially, and scholars of this period like to use similar terms. From 293 to 305, there are four emperors, and the modern term used to describe that is the Tetrarchy. It was not used at the time. You do find Tetrarchs, for example, in parts of Asia Minor and Judea, so literally four rulers who rule an area. But then modern scholars in the 19th century created it as a way of referring to this rule of four under Diocletian. And so when scholars came to invent a term for the preceding several years, they thought, oh, tetrarchy, oh, diarchy, rule of two. Another way to refer to, which is probably more accurate, is the imperial college, when there's more than one emperor ruling. So it's just a term of convenience. But you're exactly right. We would talk about Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus as joint emperors, as Septimius Severus and Caracalla as joint emperors, for example. But it's because of the hold that the tetrarchy has over this period that we use a similar term to describe the earlier years.
Okay, so when Maximian was made Augustus, was that an act of convenience?
It does seem to have been a big deal in the sense that, you know, he's not a relative, you know, and he's now put on the same level as Diocletian. So they're theoretically equals, but Diocletian is more equal. And it's interesting, Diocletian couldn't have been there to elevate him. We're not even sure exactly where Maximian was made Augustus, but it happened on the 1st of April. Diocletian's at Byzantium on March 22nd, and then shortly afterwards he's at Tiberias in Palestine, so he can't have been there. And this is all thanks to the work of a scholar called Timothy Barnes, who has put together all these itineraries of the emperors of this period. So if we know where they were at any particular time, he has found it.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And this was done, published in 1981, before computers or anything like
really?
That.
Really? Before yes. Google Maps?
Before Google Maps, yes. That's right. The new empire of Diocletian and Constantine.
Okay.
It's on archive.org if anyone wants to look it up for fun afterwards.
So we know that Maximian was in the west.
That's right.
And Diocletian was in the east. Were they ever in the same place? If they got together, I imagine there would be much discussion, much negotiation, and perhaps a party.
Yes.
And a panegyric or two.
And a panegyric, of course. Yes, party and panegyric. It can't get any better. Between 285 and 293, we know that they met only three times. So in Milan, July 285, when Maximian's made Caesar. In 288, Diocletian's campaigning in Raetia, so that's modern-day Switzerland. They met somewhere, we don't know where. And in the winter of 290, 291, so this is the Northern Hemisphere winter, December, January, the pair of them meet in Milan. And that is one we do have that recorded in a panegyric. So most of the time, government discussions between the two of them must have been by letter. They're both Augustus. So that means they both have a Praetorian prefect. They both have high office holders. You know, they have a secretary of letters, a secretary of petitions, etc. But Diocletian is still, he's the Jovian one. He is still senior. But it's really interesting, you know, that these two men who aren't related, you know, that they must have been bound together by their previous service to trust each other, I suppose.
Yeah, I just find this so fascinating and just, oh, really? They weren't challenging each other at all? They both got an army and yet they're both getting on fine?
I mean, spoiler alert, there will be some shenanigans with Maximian about 20 years on, but I'll leave that for the future.
Okay. I imagine both being Augusti, that they've got a certain amount of autonomy. Just, you know, day-to-day operations, what's happening in their area and everything.
There has to be. There has to be the way they operated. And that's why they both have, you know, this sort of Palatine establishment of those key advisors. It's like doubled, essentially. Maximian is mainly based in Trier and Milan. Diocletian moves around between Nicomedia, Antioch, Sirmium, in Pannonia, etc. Maximian also occasionally goes to Rome as well, so it's not entirely neglected. His daughter Fausta is actually born in Rome. We know that, in 290.
Yeah.
So Rome isn't off the beaten path, but, you know, he's mainly concerned with warfare, and so if he's going to go to North Italy, Milan is the best staging post.
So quite early in their joint rule, we get the instance of a... It's not even a usurper. I'm not going to call this guy a usurper because he doesn't try and take power or become emperor. He tries to become acknowledged as a triarchy.
Yes, a triarchy. Yes, so this is Carausius.
Yeah.
And I love Carausius. He is a former military officer who served under Maximian, and he is proclaimed Augustus, so he does rebel, but then he wants to be recognized by Diocletian and Maximian as the third member of their team.
Mm.
This is really ambitious. So he's often been compared to, like, the previous Gallic emperors, but they didn't want to join with Gallienus, whereas Carausius, you know, wants to join the diarchy and become a triarchy. He's really fascinating. We do actually know quite a bit about him, both from the literary sources, but also his coinage is spectacular. That gives us an insight into his regime.
Okay, so you said that he served with Maximian, so they've got a history.
Yes, so his full name is Marcus Aurelius Mausaeus Carausius, and he's from Menapia, which is a coastal region of Gallia, Belgica, next to the North Sea. And as a youth, he plied his trade as a sailor on merchant vessels and then entered the Roman army. And this is when he served with Maximian in the campaign against the Bagaldi. And he was such a successful officer, such a loyal officer, he was then given the task of preparing a new fleet against the Franks and Saxons who are raiding the coastline of Gaul. And of course, this is a major problem for, you know, the Gallic aristocracy who own estates. You know, they're doing trade. You know, these are the people that, you know, would come to Maximian's court at Trier and petition him to, you know, to do something about this issue. Carausius is given a significant force to prepare the fleet, but also to fight against the pirates, probably about 9,000 men. We know there are detachments from 9 legions coming from Britain and the Rhine and Danubian frontiers. So the legion itself remains there, but they sort of hive off about 1,000 men into what is known as a vexillatio, a vexillation, and then these vexillations can combine to form a new force. So with these 9,000 men, Carausius is successful. He defeats the Franks and Saxon pirates, sees their booty, but he keeps some of it for himself.
Right.
Maximian is not happy Jan and sentences him to death.
Sorry, you used a very Australian reference that nobody will get.
Maximian is displeased with what is going on. Quite understandably, and yes, sentences him to death. We do have a substantial Australian audience.
Oh, we do. But, you know.
That is quite niche.
Yes. Circa advertising, you know, 2002.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm showing my age as well.
When Yellow Pages was still a thing.
Yes. YouTuber to everyone else. Yeah. And so Carausius, sentenced to death, says, I'm not putting up with this. He's proclaimed emperor. and he manages to control both parts of Northern Gaul as well as all Roman territory in Britain.
Mm. Now, how much of his control of Roman Britain was realistic? Because I sometimes get the feeling that Roman Britain doesn't really quite know what's going on.
Yeah, so let's just say the provinces. So certainly, you know, Britannia Inferior, Britannia Superior, they're the main provinces. You know, he won't control Scotland. He won't control most of Wales. Mm. You know, certainly not Ireland. but the provinces he seems to have a fairly good sway over.
Yeah.
And we do actually have one milestone of his from Britain. And this provides us with his name, Malzaeus. So he's M. Aurelius Mals Carausius on the milestone there.
You mentioned that a lot of what we know about him comes from his coinage. We've got quite a lot of his coinage. I think there was a couple of good hoards that were discovered not too long ago.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because it's a period of warfare, of civil war, of turbulence, piracy as well, people are burying their coinage in pots. And when they're discovered, they're a boon to scholars searching through for new types. One of the reasons why Carausius' coinage is so interesting is that it's so original. He and his administration are clearly issuing orders about what the coins should feature. Let me give you some examples. So there are coins praising him as the restorer of Britain, coins praising the spirit of Britain, coins indicating that he's the renovator, the restorer of Rome. And you might think, okay, so far, you know, not too different. You know, we've had the spirit of the Illyrian armies before, the restorer of Illyrian. But some of them actually bear quite explicit references to lines of the poet Virgil. And this is new. So some of them have the legend expectate veni, so come, long-awaited one, the idea that, you know, Carausius is their long-awaited saviour. He is someone who's going to care about the Britons. And then some other coins have acronyms, RSR, on them. This is a line from Virgil, Redeunt Saturnia Regna, the golden age returns. And you might think, oh, how do you know that's from Virgil?
I was about to say, how do you know that those three letters refer to a line from Virgil? That is really impressive detective work.
So, and we should give full credit to Guy de la Boissière. So he's the man who figured this out. There is a medallion that has another acronym, INPCDA. And this has puzzled scholars, you know, for centuries. But almost certainly it stands for Iam Noah Progenies Caelo Dimittiter Alto, which is the rest of this line from Virgil.
I see.
So the Golden Age returns. Now new offspring, new generation is sent down from heaven above.
Mm.
So RSR, in and of itself, you might think, oh, it doesn't really refer to that line from Virgil.
But when you take them both together.
Both together, it can't be anything else. It can't be anything else. It must be these lines referring to the return of the Golden Age, which will happen under Carausius.
Mm.
And yeah, this is a very sophisticated allusion as well. The fact that RSI appears on coins and medallions, INPCDA, just on a medallion. What are medallions for? They're for commemorating special events like New Year's Day, for victories, and they're usually handed out by emperors to their closest adherents. So courtiers, leading military officers, and generals.
Mm.
So they're not going to be in wide circulation.
Okay, so I suppose the direct analogy for modern times is maybe challenge coins, if you've heard of those.
No, I haven't. What are challenge coins?
It's quite big in America, but it's mostly big in the military as well.
Okay.
And if you're meeting somebody important or whatever, you can give them a coin, which will signify the ship that you serve on like that. It sounds like that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's about building the loyalty between the emperor and his leading officers, certainly. And, you know, a lot of thought has gone into these. They're well carved. Artistry has got into the designs. The medallions are bronze,
yeah,
but the coins that feature RSR and some of these other legends are denarii, so they are legal tender, but they're a much higher standard than previous 3rd century coinage, so they have more silver, essentially. He wants to be known as an emperor who pays the troops.
So can the use of the Virgil quotes, the metal content of these coins, can that tell us anything about Carausius, or am I wrong to make those sort of inferences? Like, fan of Virgil, was he a man of the books?
Yeah, yeah. And we all make these inferences because this is what we have to go on.
Yeah.
That he is someone who is in it for the long haul. He sees his regime as something that's not just ephemeral. He means to last. You know, he's portraying himself as the return of a golden age. He portrays himself as, you know, the protector of Britain and the peoples in that area. The idea is that, you know, you have to know Virgil to understand these allusions. So certainly he himself or someone in his government would know that and would expect, you know, the senior military officers to know Virgil as well. His coinage also features so many allusions to the sea. So there's galleys, there's images of abundant, the fruits of the sea. There are coins minted with the bust of the god Oceanus, the deified ocean. And Neptune is portrayed as his special divine companion in the same way that Jupiter and Hercules are for Diocletian and Maximian. And this, I've argued in an article, is, you know, part of his mythologizing of his past, the same way that, you know, Maximian's Pannonian origin, that's his story about why he is the best man for the job. Carausius, you know, was a sailor in his youth and now ruling the sea and protecting the people under his sway. So I see himself, you know, competing with Maximian and Diocletian, but also, you know, making a claim that he's essentially their equal.
Yeah. So he directly promotes himself on his coinage as well as being a third member of the imperial family.
Yes, so he mints coins that have three busts on them. So Diocletian, Carausius, and Maximian are portrayed what we call jugate busts, in the sense that they're joined. There's three of them in profile all together.
Yeah.
And there's the legend, Carausius et fratres sui, Carausius and his brothers. So he's making a claim to be part of this fraternal brotherhood.
Yeah.
And he also mints coins with the legend Pax and then Aug with three G's. And that means three Augusti. Pax Augustorum, which is the plural. But if you add three G's, that means there's three of them. So if people are exchanging his coinage, they think, oh, he's just a normal emperor.
True.
You know, yep. He's part of the brotherhood with Diocletian and Maximian.
Mm.
So he wanted to be recognized, as you said, as part of the triarchy.
So that's not going to happen.
Alas, no.
He's in Maximian's territory, really.
He is. He is.
So he becomes Maximian's problem to clean up. And also the problem that he started, perhaps.
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, Carausius was quite wrong to steal the booty. But,
yeah, I know. But this was meant to be a trusted fellow soldier.
Yes. Carausius is a major thorn in Maximian's side. So he seems to have lost his Gallic territory by 289 and was confined to Britain and the Channel. And so the panegyric of 289, delivered at Trier, calls Carausius a pirate who is looking on at Maximian's armies who are on the point of penetrating that channel. So the idea is that Maximian is readying a fleet to recapture Britain.
Mm.
Now, in all of the panegyrics, Carausius is never named himself. So this is a technique of denigrating your opponent. You don't give them their name, but instead he's called a pirate or an arch-pirate, a pirate captain there, demonizing him as, you know, part of these, you know, Frankish and Saxon enemies, which he was supposed to save Romans from. And so the speaker of 289 says that Maximian has built fleets which, I quote, are about to reach the ocean simultaneously via every river. And you might think, oh, but it's just the English Channel. For Romans, the Gallic coast was the beginning of ocean.
Mm.
So it wasn't just a sea. It was this huge expanse of water. And so even, you know, we might think, oh, you know, you can get on a ferry. It's really, really quickly. For them, this was a major a barrier too. So this is where ocean began.
Yeah.
The orator says it's going to be an act of divine providence which will enable the emperor's fleet to launch into the ocean. that he, Maximian, has ocean on his side. And the orator says, "But behold, suddenly when it was needful to launch the warcraft, for you, earth, put forth its copious springs, for you, Jupiter poured forth rains in abundance, for you, ocean overflowed all the riverbanks." So, you know, this contests Carausius' own claims to control the ocean. Instead, it all works for Maximian. And once again, you have that wonderful anaphora repetition, for you, for you, for you, which is tibi in the original Latin. So to really emphasize that everything is supplicating itself to Maximian.
It brings mythology and gods into the side of Maximian.
That's right. And don't forget, he's the Herculean one. And so there's a gold aureus, a gold coin minted at this time, which shows Hercules defeating Antaeus, the son of the sea god Neptune. And this is a clear allusion to the hope that Maximian will defeat Carausius.
Mm.
And again, these gold coins form part of donatives for the troops at this time. So we not only have sort of big hoards with lots of silver or bronze coins, we also have like these donative hoards, which are found in France and Belgium, which have gold aurei. They have some medallions. They have golden fibulae, so
fastness, they fasten cloak, the cloak, yeah.
Yeah, and other treasures, you know, silver plate and things like that, which are clearly the belongings of officers. And in one case, we can even trace that this is handed from a father officer to a son officer as well.
What?
Because of some inscriptions that are carved on to the fibulae.
Nice.
So the audience for these coins, the high worth ones, are clearly military officers.
Mm.
However, we know that Maximian's campaign failed because the panegyric of 291 only alludes to victories over Carausius' Frankish allies and says nothing about a great victory by this fleet and says nothing about Carausius being defeated. He's still out there.
We can take care of what's over on the mainland.
That's right.
Yeah, but there's still the greater problem, and if Carausius was taken care of, it would be in this panegyric.
That's right.
Okay. This was in the panegyric that's delivered in 291. So how has the situation evolved since then?
Well, we know that Diocletian comes west to meet with Maximian. So a big part of the panegyric of 291 is this meeting in the winter of 290, 291 in Milan. It's almost certain that what to do about Carausius was going to be on the agenda there, you know, whether they should recognize him as a co-emperor, the failure of Maximian's expedition, what would be the steps that they should take.
How are they going to deal with that situation?
Obviously, they decide to continue the fight against him, and the panegyric ends with an expression of hope of victory against Carausius. And the orator says, "The same stars which procure for you eternal harmony and the affection of your offspring and your assiduous care for the state promise you, in addition to the victories gained throughout the world, a naval victory as well."
Mm.
And the orator goes on to say that, you know, the spoils from this victory will adorn the rostra in Rome, the speaker's platform, which is called that because in Rome's great naval battle against the Latin allies off Antium in 338 BC, they took the prows from the Latin ships and affixed them to the speaker's platform.
Mm.
And from then it was known as the rostra. And so the orator hopes that the victory over Carausius will also bring more decorations for the rostra as well. And I should also give credit to Ted Nixon and Barbara Rogers, who, you know, have done these fantastic translations of the panegyrics, which I've been reading out because, you know, it's very difficult Latin and they do a great job of bringing it to life in English as well.
This almost sounds like Maximian's performance review.
Yes.
Let's see if you're meeting your goals.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the KPIs are not good. I think, dislodge Carausius, fail.
Ship mishap.
Yes, exactly. Ocean not for you. And so one of the things that the orator emphasizes is how the emperors can be everywhere and how fast they move. The orator says, "You both, when we thought you were busy in the east and west, suddenly appeared in the lap of Italy." So that's Milan. all of your provinces, which you travel through with divine speed, do not know from one moment to the next where you are. Yet they do know that you have conquered everywhere. So, you know, the emperors are so fast, they're like lightning speed, you know, going here and there and destroying enemies.
I mean, it's making it sound impressive, but it's also, you know, dude, could have done with more notice.
Yeah, yes. Well, they do have to put up the emperors as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
The orator goes on about, so Maximian has to cross the Alps to go from Trier to Milan. He talks about Hannibal, but of course this is much better because he's not an invading force. He's a force of good. And that he, you know, talks about people leaving their work to come and gaze on Maximian as he advances. But when you came closer and closer and people began to recognize you, all the fields were filled not only with men running forth to see, but even with flocks of beasts leaving their pastures and their woods. The idea that even animals want to gaze on you, Emperor, you're so fantastic. And he talks about the shining light which comes over the Alps as well. It's really good stuff. And then, of course, there's the emperors themselves. So I'm going to read out some more passages when Diocletian and Maximian actually enter Milan and people look at them. But when you pass through the door and rode together through the middle of the city, the very buildings, I hear, almost move themselves, when every man, woman, tiny child, an aged person, either ran out through the doors into the open or hung out of the upper thresholds of the houses. All cried out for joy. Then openly, without fear of you, they pointed with their hands. Do you see, Diocletian? Do you see, Maximian? Both are here. They are together. How closely they sit. How amicably they converse. How quickly they pass by. No one's eyes were equal to his desire for looking. And while they eagerly marvelled at each of you in turn, they were able to see enough of neither. The image, you know, the streets being crowded, you know, these are emperors who don't live there, and it's such a spectacle to see them both together.
This is Princess Di and Charles coming to visit Australia.
That's exactly right.
This is the Beatles landing in Adelaide.
Yes, yeah, that's right. You know, they're going to go and hug a koala and everything like that. Everyone is hanging out to see them.
A big party and a big reception, and how lucky are we to have both the emperors in one space?
That's exactly right.
Very panegyric worthy.
And also, Rome is jealous.
Because Rome would be jealous.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. They're not there. They're in Milan.
Yeah.
The orator has to make it seem like this is, you know, the natural order of things now. So the orator goes on to say, even Rome herself, the mistress of nations, in a transport of extravagant joy at your proximity, and in an attempt to get a glimpse of you from the summits of her own mountains, the closer to sate herself with your countenances, advanced as near as she could to get a look. Indeed, she had sent the leaders of her senate, freely imparting to the city of Milan, most blessed during those days, a semblance of her own majesty, so that the seat of imperial power could then appear to be the place to which each emperor had come. So the Latin there is the sedes imperii, the seat of empire. The idea is that wherever the emperor is, that's where Rome is. And the sense that we have all these sort of big capital cities around the empire. There's not just one. Rome has to share itself with the others. So Trier, Milan, Sirmium, Nicomedia, Antioch, they are all what we call capitals during yeah. this period. The Senate is still based in Rome, but if it wants a part of the action most of the time, it has to send an embassy somewhere else. So this panegyric is a reflection of the changed reality of imperial power.
Yeah, it's been an interesting slow erosion for Rome.
Yes.
Sometimes I forget, you know, that I've been making a Roman history podcast for 10 years and how little Rome matters at this point.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
It's very much that where the emperor is the capital.
That's
but
right.
But at the same time, you know, this story will continue to devolve to where the capital of the empire is Constantinople.
That's right.
So,
yes, yeah.
Yeah, the city itself is no longer the Roman Empire.
Yes, except in the late 5th century, in the dying days, Rome becomes really important again as the seat of emperors.
Mm.
So, but yes, a lot of the 4th century, visits are rare to the city of Rome. This panegyric really gives voice to that sort of changed reality there.
That was Kaelin Davenport,
head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any friendly neighbourhood podcatching platform. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.